It is Friday, July the 28th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, more U.S. sanctions on Russia, Iran, and North Korea, plus Israel moving security measures, removing them at the Old City Jerusalem holy site.
Israel backed down because Israel climbed up the ladder or the tree that it shouldn't have had in the first place.
Also, transatlantic relations.
The transatlantic relationship is by far the world's most significant trading and economic relationship. If you look at the numbers, they're vast. The amount of foreign direct investment going both ways across the Atlantic is surprisingly huge.
Also, social media, women's quotes, it's all ahead on VOA. Thanks for being with us. I'm Steve Norman. We're all here in Washington for you, and we begin with the U.S. Senate. It has voted decisively to approve a new package of stiff financial sanctions against Russia, as well as Iran and North Korea. The Senate passed the bill 98-2, 2 days after the House of Representatives pushed the measure through an overwhelmingly 419-3 vote. Ben Cardin, a Democrat, is a U.S. Senator from the state of Maryland.
That's a strong message that the United States Senate is united, that we will take tough action against Russia for their attack against the United States in our elections, for their interference in the sovereignty of countries in Europe, from Ukraine to Georgia to Moldova, to what they have done in Syria in supporting war crimes.
And Tennessee Republican Senator Bob Corker admits even though it is a very popular bill, President Trump might not necessarily favor it.
I've had conversations with the President and Secretary Tillerson over the course of last week. I've gotten no indication whatsoever that that they plan to consider a veto. So it passed overwhelmingly, and I get no indication that's even being discussed.
Both the House and Senate votes are veto-proof, as the White House has wavered on whether the President should sign the measure into law. And the White House has broached the possibility that President Trump will veto the new sanctions on Russia, Iran, and North Korea, prompting some sharp criticism from lawmakers on Capitol Hill. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman is following the story.
White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci told CNN Thursday that President Trump may sign sweeping sanctions into law, or he may veto them, quote, and negotiate an even tougher deal against the Russians. Even the hint of a veto brought swift reaction from lawmakers on Capitol Hill, including Republican Senator John Cornyn.
Oh, I think that would be a very bad mistake. I think what would be better if they'd work with us on the legislation.
It's hard to understand what comes out of the White House.
Ben Cardin is the top Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
This gives the president a stronger hand dealing with Mr. Putin. If he vetoes it, it means he doesn't want a stronger hand in dealing with Mr. Putin.
Lawmakers predicted a presidential veto would be overridden, given that the sanctions bill passed the House of Representatives 419-3 Tuesday, and a similarly lopsided vote is expected in the Senate. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer derided as laughable Scaramucci's assertion that Trump could negotiate even tougher sanctions against Russia.
I'm a New Yorker, too, and I know bull when I hear it.
The bill gives Congress the power to block any presidential move to suspend punitive measures against Moscow, Tehran, and Pyongyang. The Trump administration initially resisted what it saw as an attempt to limit executive authority. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
Also in the news, Israeli police say Palestinian worshippers clashed outside a revered holy site in the Old City within Jerusalem after Israel removed the final elements of security measures that it had installed earlier this month. Israeli police say Palestinians threw rocks at Israeli police, who responded with tear gas as well as rubber bullets as they were stationed at the gate to the site. According to the Palestinian Red Crescent, at least 100 Palestinians were hurt in the confrontation, issuing and including some who were hit by rubber bullets or even beaten. The clashes arose from Muslim leaders in Jerusalem giving permission for their worshipers to re-enter the site, which had been boycotted over the increased security measures. Gerson Baskin, co-founder of the Israeli-Palestinian Creative Regional Initiative, tells my colleague Victor Beatty the dispute is not about the security measures put in place, but ultimately who controls the holy site.
Throughout the past 50 years in which Israel has occupied the site, which is the most holy site for the Jewish people, it has reached agreements with the Muslim officials, either Jordanian or Palestinian, on how to keep the security of the site. And this time, Israel decided to take unilateral measures in response to the terrorist attack that was there. And that's what the whole argument is about now. Who owns the place? Who has the right to decide? So even though Israel put in metal detectors and cameras and has subsequently removed them, enormous police and military presence around the old city of Jerusalem and around the Al-Aqsa compound is such that the Palestinians are still refusing to enter space and return to normal life and pray there until everything goes back to what it was prior to July 14th.
Has Israel backed down, in your view?
Israel backed down because Israel climbed up the ladder or the tree that it shouldn't have had in the first place. Immediately when the terrorist attack took place, Israel should have convened a meeting behind the scenes, as it used to do, with the Muslim officials and say, we have a real security problem here. We want to protect everyone who goes to pray there. We want to protect the sanctity of the space. Let's figure out how to do it. I'm sure that they could have come to a compromise of even putting metal detectors in the place, but it would have been rough putting the metal detectors and then doing the checking and not the Israelis. There could be security solutions here, but not when both sides are flexing their muscles to assert who controls the place.
Are there any new security measures still in place, or have they all been removed?
I think they've all been removed except for the very heavy presence now and an Israeli announcement that it would conduct individual security checks as seen fit, and that the plan for putting in sophisticated high-tech cameras has been voted on by the Israeli cabinet and money allocated to do that. That will take months to do, but the Palestinians want that decision to be removed as well.
Gerson Baskin also said if protests occur today, it will result in more violence. He said tensions are similar to what preceded the Second Intifada by Palestinians in the year 2000 that left thousands dead. The charged atmosphere ironically comes as Israel marks the 50th anniversary of its capture of Jerusalem during the Six-Day War. Gerson Baskin is co-founder of the Israeli-Palestinian Creative Regional Initiative, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. We turn our attention now to transatlantic relations as we hear from Adam Klein, the Robert M. Gates Senior Fellow at the Center for New American Security, who appeared on the VOA program Press Conference USA, hosted by Carol Castiel and her guest host, VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selton. Here's Carol Castiel.
We just witnessed the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany, and we saw rather strained relations between the Trump administration and the European Union countries and some of the other G20 countries. We saw differences on the Paris Climate Accord, international trade, and immigration. What impact, in your view, is this sort of strained relationship between the Trump administration and some of these countries having on this ever-present terrorist threat in Europe
many foreign fighters coming back from Iraq and Syria, and some of the homegrown jihadis?
Well, that's a great question. First, I'd like to say that as a former Robert Bosch fellow, I spent a year in Berlin, Germany. I've also studied French for many years. So this is a relationship that's personally important to me and where I have a fair amount of personal experience. I think it's important to introduce a bit of historical perspective here. During the Reagan administration, there were significant transatlantic tensions over things like the deployment of U.S. intermediate range ballistic missiles in Western Europe with nuclear weapons, obviously. During the second Bush administration, we saw significant tensions over the Iraq War. And I think the pattern we've seen throughout these tensions, which to some extent derive from the U.S. and Europe different geopolitical positions in the post-war era, to some extent, some have argued from inherent differences in outlook between Americans and Europeans. But the pattern that we've seen is that eventually both sides find their way back to working together. And I think that's what will happen here as well eventually. And the reasons for that are both based in our common values, which are much deeper than the things that divide us, but also the ways that we need each other. And those are persistent dynamics in the relationship. So just to give a few examples, the transatlantic relationship is by far the world's most significant trading and economic relationship. If you look at the numbers, they're vast. The amount of foreign direct investment going both ways across the Atlantic is surprisingly huge if you drill down into the numbers and compare it to the overhyped investments in other parts of the world, frankly. In counterterrorism, which you mentioned, there's a very deep cooperation and information sharing. And candidly, we've seen a lot of European pushback on certain issues lately, but they need our assistance on counterterrorism, and our intelligence services are consistently and very willingly providing it, as we should be. I've been told in confidential settings that the ratio of counterterrorism data that the U.S. sends to Europe is 9 times greater than that which we receive back in return. It's not a value judgment one way or another, but we are providing very great behind-the-scenes assistance to European counterterrorism, and I think ultimately these dynamics will bring the relationship back together.
So notwithstanding these tensions, that counterterrorism relationship and intelligence sharing remains strong and robust.
It does. I've heard, again, from sort of confidential discussions, that in the wake of the Paris attacks, one of the first things that French authorities did was to contact the U.S. intelligence community and ask it to use its collection capabilities to target those who were suspected of perpetrating the attack. And there are very good reasons for that. The U.S. invests very heavily in these capabilities, and we use them not only to protect ourselves, but also to protect our allies. And again, that's as it should be.
Let me turn to my colleague Jeff Selden for a question.
Just following up on this line of thought, is there a difference between the personal relationships that people in the U.S. intelligence communities and the European intelligence communities have forged, and then the trust that exists right now, or perhaps the lack of trust that exists with the administration? And what type of tension could that cause, and how do you see the European countries and the U.S. moving beyond that? On the lower levels, obviously, there's a desire and a very good relationship. But when you talk to Western diplomats, European diplomats, you do hear there's some skepticism, there's some concern about how the administration is pursuing its path right now.
I actually think there's more parallel there between the intelligence-to-intelligence community relationships and the politician-to-politician relationships than maybe the question suggests. So on the intelligence side, obviously, these are professionals. They're career professionals. They're in the same secretive world with the same norms and understandings, and they've worked together for many years. So there's a deep connection there that's hard to sever. On the political side, again, these are people who are very pragmatic, who have to work together to get things done. And so ultimately what we've seen is that leaders find a way to work together on topics of mutual interest, even if the interpersonal dynamics are fraught. I think where the challenge is, and maybe this is what you were getting at a bit, is that we need public support ultimately to underpin all of this collaboration. So if the public is vehemently opposed to relations with the United States in a given country, it will be difficult for that country's leaders to work with the United States collaboratively. Similarly, if the public is opposed to, say, intelligence sharing with the United States or is concerned about U.S. intelligence activities on its soil, then there will be pressure for that country to push back against those activities and to cut off that cooperation. And so I think the challenge for the U.S. national security community is to build that trust. Here at home, of course, we always need to do that, but internationally as well, to communicate better to people exactly what the U.S. intelligence community is allowed to do, all of the many legal safeguards that exist that limit those things. And I should add that many of those legal safeguards apply to non-Americans as well. And then also the very, very rigorous oversight mechanisms that we have in place, ranging from Congress to the courts to things within the executive branch. And then finally, and perhaps this is the most important, the transparency measures that the U.S. intelligence community has taken to tell Americans, but also the world, more about what we do.
That's Adam Klein. He is a Robert M. Gates Senior Fellow at the Center for a New American Security. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Castiel and National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Well, Turkey's prime minister has met with executives of leading German businesses operating in Turkey in a bid to allay concerns over German-Turkish tensions. According to a number of reports, a number of German companies are under investigation for alleged links to last year's failed coup. We get more now from Dorian Jones in Istanbul.
Prime Minister Binali Yildirim sat down with executives of German companies in Turkey, bringing the message they have nothing to fear.
İş yapan Alman şirketlerine soruşturma başlatıldığı yönünde.
Yildirim said the government views the companies as part of the Turkish economy. He said it's out of the question that German companies could pay a price for the state of relations between Turkey and Germany. His comments come after Turkish authorities sent a list to Berlin of German companies allegedly implicated in last year's failed coup to unseat President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Ankara has said the list was sent by mistake and that German companies were not under investigation. But with nearly 1,000 Turkish companies seized in the post-coup crackdown and German nationals also held, business analysts warn there is growing concern among German companies in Turkey. Global Source Partners political consultant Attila Yeşilada warns Yildirim's comments may do little to allay concerns.
I think it's a nice gesture, but I don't think it's going to alleviate any of the problems, and I don't think it's going to end the chill over German or European investment, because the story is much bigger than the companies themselves. It's a question of property rights, respect for law, and what kind of guarantees can be given that their employees would not be implicated in some kind of investigation.
Tensions increased after Turkey detained German human rights activist Peter Stuitner earlier this month. He's one of 10 German nationals held in the crackdown. Berlin is suspicious that detentions are part of Ankara's efforts to pressure Germany to extradite people accused of being involved in the July coup attempt. Analyst Yeşilada says Ankara needs to take concrete steps to increase German business confidence.
Turkey could at any point release Mr. Stoltenberg and, you know, other names that so annoyed Germany with their arrests. But assuming this will not be the case, because Mr. Erdogan said, we'll catch your agents and trample over them.
But Ankara could pay an economic price for the tensions with its biggest trading partner. Berlin has warned it could reduce or end credit guarantees for German companies importing from Turkey, which could cost the Turkish economy up to $2 billion a year. Tourism could also be hit. Berlin has issued a travel warning for Turkey. The biggest threat, some regional analysts say, is the possibility of Western banks reducing loans the Turkish economy depends on. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And now it's time for what's trending on social media with International Editions, Andrew Palchevsky.
Trending today, President Trump's tweets causing some controversy and some big earnings for some big companies. But we start with President Trump and the fallout that continues after his series of tweets Wednesday rescinding the rule that allowed transgendered members of the U.S. military. Now, reportedly, this policy change and the tweets announcing it were not known to some officials at the Department of Defense. They were caught off guard by that. Also catching them off guard, the fact that this announcement was made in a series of three tweets. Now, I want to read to you the first tweet that President Trump sent out. It said, quote, "After consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow." And that's where the tweet ends. It wasn't until 9 minutes later, when President Trump sent his second tweet, that it became clear what he was talking about and this ban on transgendered service members. But for those 9 minutes, there was reported confusion and even some panic at the Department of Defense, some there thinking that President Trump was going to launch military action because there wasn't any context for the tweet that he first sent out. This is just one of the many stories that we're beginning to learn about as the questions continue to swirl about this policy change and who knew about it beforehand. And from Washington, we go to Wall Street, where it's earnings time for some of the world's biggest companies, including some social media giants. And these earnings reports are giving us not just a glimpse into their financial wealth, but their overall health. For instance, Twitter beat earnings expectations, but they announced a lower than expected growth in their user base and a loss of about 2 million monthly active users here in the United States. those pieces of bad news sending their stocks downward. It was a different story, though, for social media juggernaut Facebook. Facebook not only beat earnings expectations, but they announced better-than-expected growth in both monthly active users and the number of businesses advertising on Facebook, where they make a lot of their money. And the good news wasn't just for Facebook. They announced that WhatsApp, the chat app that Facebook purchased in 2014 for nearly $20 billion, now has more than 1 billion daily users, sending out 55 billion messages and 4.5 billion photos each day around the world. That good news sent Facebook's stock to record highs. And it's not just social media companies that are reaping the rewards of good earnings. Buoyed by online retailer Amazon's earnings, that company's CEO, Jeff Bezos, overtook Microsoft founder Bill Gates as the world's richest person with a net worth of over $90 billion. That title of world's richest person helped Bezos earn another title on Thursday, top trending topic on social media.
International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
It's probably not much fun being a cow unless you live on this Wisconsin farm.
But a deep, soft bedding of sand creates an environment where cows can rest half the day.
Nigel Cook is the director of the Dairyland Initiative, a University of Wisconsin program promoting, through workshops, the good treatment of cows, which also makes them more profitable. Mitch Brewing is with Mystic Valley Dairy.
If you take away their stress, they actually produce more milk.
These cows enjoy misting sprays, fans supply soft breezes, and yes, these cows, they get back rubs. Brewing says his cows live longer, they have fewer injuries, and actually eat less, but milk production on his farm is up 2 gallons a day for each cow from using the techniques from the Dairyland Initiative.
Industry where 10 cents can make a huge difference.
For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Maya Angelou once said, "Sister, when you get, give. When you learn, teach." Well, the late American author and poet, one of the most quoted women in the world, and her words are included in a new book of women's quotes. Pauline Wieger is author of Beautifully Said. VOA's Faith Labadus tells us Wieger included the story behind each quotation in the book to inspire and empower others.
When Pauline Wieger decided to change careers from corporate marketing to nonprofit work, she started writing a book about her transition. And when she was looking for quotations to use in the book, she didn't find enough accurately sourced quotes attributed to women. So, with the help of a team of researchers, Wieger created Quotable, a website of women's quotes and the stories behind them. And instead of writing about changing careers, she wrote a book of quotations.
The value of quotations actually goes back hundreds of years when people would collect snippets in order to spark their interest in a concept or to innovate an idea. So quotations actually have a wonderful legacy of being a spark for writing. And in today's modern world, it is fueled even further by how they're spread through social media.
Beautifully Said includes 110 quotations from women around the world and across the centuries, commenting on all aspects of life. 2 centuries ago, Mary Shelley, British author of Frankenstein, wrote, "Invention, it must be humbly admitted, does not consist in creating out of void, but out of chaos." Pakistani activist for girls' education, Malala Yousafzai, the youngest Nobel Prize laureate, said, "One child, one teacher, one book, and one pen can change the world." Wieger includes a quote from chef and cookbook author Grace Young, "Preserve your culinary legacy. Someday those recipes could be the one link we have to reach our loved ones."
We found that quotation through a blog post that she wrote about 2 years ago, right before Chinese New Year. And the story was that her mother would always, for years, prepare this traditional Chinese meal. And yet now her mother was dealing with dementia and so could not remember how to prepare the meal or anything really, frankly, about the Chinese New Year. And what Grace found was that when she prepared this meal, it created connections with her mother.
Uyghur says many of the most powerful quotations reflect women's thoughts when facing challenges, such as dancer Adrienne Haslett. She lost part of her leg in the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing, but a year later was dancing again on a bionic leg. Her quote is from a TV interview after the attack.
One of the producers or someone said, the victims in this, and I said, I'm not a victim. Being a victim means that I belong to someone. And then I said, you know, I'm not a victim defined by what happened in my life. I'm a survivor defined by how I live my life. I said, I refuse to be called a victim. And they said, wait, say that again. And I said, oh, what did I say? Because I was so in the moment. When I wrote it down that time, it became a mantra in my life. You know, you don't have to be defined by this terrible tragedy that happened in your life. You can choose to rewrite your story as it moves forward.
Moving forward is also the focus of mountain climber Alison Levine's quote, sometimes you have to go backwards in order to eventually get to where you want to be.
The story behind the quotation is that, you know, I was the team captain for the first American women's Mount Everest expedition. And people mistakenly think that when you climb Everest, you just climb straight up the mountain from base camp to camp one to camp two to camp three, you know, camp four, and then the summit. But that's not how it works. You actually keep coming back down because you have to let your body get used to the altitude very slowly. It's this process called acclimatization. So you have to actually climb back down the mountain in order to eventually get to the summit.
Author Pauline Uyghur says she hopes Beautifully Said will inspire women and girls to create their own quotable quotes. For writer Faisal Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Very nice. Quotes do mean something in most of our lives. For our director Tracy Carter and engineer Zainab Abdul-Rahman, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States applauds the Council on the European Union's recent decision to sanction 16 Syrian military officials and scientists for their roles in the development and use of chemical weapons on civilian populations on behalf of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The sanctions on 8 members of the Scientific Studies and Research Center, as well as 8 high-ranking officials, follow upon similar actions by the U.S. and other allies aimed at holding the Assad government accountable for violating the United Nations Chemical Weapons Convention by gassing its own people. Such attacks include one on the town of Khan Shaykhun in Idlib province last April. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has determined that sarin gas was used in the attack, which killed at least 82 civilians, including children. U.S. and other Western intelligence reports say the Assad regime was responsible. According to the United Nations, there were also 3 incidents in 2016 where chlorine gas was used on civilians. The sanctions will freeze the financial assets of the 16 Syrians and restrict their ability to travel. The United States is committed to reducing civilian suffering in Syria and recently agreed with Russia and Jordan to support a ceasefire and the delivery of humanitarian assistance in the southwest region. Russia has backed the Assad regime in the conflict. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called the agreement the first indication the U.S. and Russia can work together in Syria, and it noted hopes that the progress can be replicated with further ceasefires throughout the country. Russia, said Secretary Tillerson, has the same, I think, interest that we do in having Syria become a stable place, a unified place, but ultimately a place where we can facilitate a political discussion about the future, including the future leadership of Syria. He made clear, however, that the Assad regime has lost credibility with the international community. We think it will be difficult, he said, for them to attract both the humanitarian aid as well as the reconstruction assistance that's going to be required because there just will be such a low level of confidence in the Assad government. How Assad leaves is yet to be determined, said Secretary Tillerson. But our view is that somewhere in that political process, there will be a transition away from the Assad family.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.